This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
New voices in your head.
It's radio.
Free
radio.
The F Word, Vancouver's explicitly feminist radio show. Filling your head with naughty feminist ideas since 2007. The F Word is a syndicated show produced in Vancouver, BC, Canada at CFRO 100.5 FM, Vancouver's cooperative radio station. And every Monday from noon to 1, we broadcast live from the downtown east side of Vancouver, unceded Coast Salish territory. I'm Ariana Bearer, here with Nicole Deegan.
On today's show, we'll be playing an interview our Toronto-based contributor, Ellie Gordon-Marshall, recently recorded with Joelle Tilia, the Executive Director of Literature for Life. Literature for Life is a Toronto-based organization committed to assisting marginalized young mothers unleash their intellectual potential through the simple idea of reading novels and writing stories. Since its founding in 2000, Literature for Life has distributed 20,000 books to young mothers and their children.
So I started Literature for Life 12 years ago because as a former teacher, I saw that there were a lot of deficits in educational opportunities, particularly for marginalized communities. My focus really has been on single, pregnant, and parenting teen mothers because they generally will leave school because they're having difficulty at school due to other social pressures. And most of our clients actually become pregnant after they leave school. What I know from my own teaching experience is that children of single mothers in particular are starting school with huge school readiness deficits. And so they, unless they have a special intervention, they never catch up. And we see often in all the statistics that the results of teen pregnancy are intergenerational. So they're more likely to be living in poverty, they're more likely to drop out of school, be involved with law enforcement, be sort of cyclically dependent upon the welfare system. And so I really believe that we can't just ignore a certain population. We need to be able to give them the supports that they need to be successful, and that every child that's born has value. And one of the ways that I could see in my experience of enhancing those values was by working with the mothers to increase their literacy capacity, and then they become models for their children. They read to their children, they become better advocates at school, they have more self-confidence, they're able to access other educational opportunities and eventually pursue career opportunities. So over the last 12 years, we've worked with approximately 2,000 women, and we've given out 20,000 books, because the biggest predictor of whether a child will finish high school is how many books are in the house. It's regardless of the education of the parents, the socioeconomic background of the parents. And that was research done on a global level by the University of Nevada and the University of Auckland. So they did a 20-year global study, and they looked at all determinants of success in school, including socioeconomic issues, education of the parents, whether they were urban or rural. And this was the common factor, was how many books were in the house, even if the parents were illiterate. So what we're trying to do here is help the families build not only a library for themselves, but also for their children. The method that we've used, and this has been my experience as a former teacher, was promoting ideas and getting youth engaged and empowered in being able to dissect and learn about those new ideas. So there is lots of very good research done on the power of reading narrative in terms of developing empathy skills, social skills, and better community skills. And these are kind of the grounding of what we're doing. The approach that we take is different than most literacy programs where, you know, somebody comes in a classroom and they're given a book and they learn what a noun is and what a verb is and vocabulary. What we do is we put them into sort of like a whole language methodology, which means that we read novels that are relevant to the women. So because they see themselves in the characters, they start reading the book. And even those that have really poor literacy skills, their literacy jumps very significantly because they're in an environment that is safe. It's run by a facilitator who is generally an arts graduate from university and a writer themselves. So it's not top-down. It's very flat, the facilitation. So it gives women space to start exploring and getting over their fear of making mistakes, of, you know, the they carry an identity that they can't be successful in school. Our program is sort of like an introduction into a new way of thinking. As the women become more fluent, and we did some surveys last year, and we saw that within 2 months, their literacy level on average increased by 18%, and that they were reading 2.5 hours more a week to their children. What that translates into is that it has an impact on their ability to be able to walk into a classroom and get that accreditation that they need to finish high school and then enter into college and university. We work with partners who are servicing single and parenting teen moms, and those are in places across the city. Our program is really different in that we don't clinicalize our young women. You know, we're not overseeing what they're doing. We're giving them an opportunity to be able to explore their own personal potential. Then we don't tell them what they can do and can't do. We show them through the experience that they have within the reading circle. I often get asked, or people often mistake the organization's name for Literacy for Life. It's interesting for me to explore that, because when I first started this organization, my belief is that literacy is the skill, and that to be successful in this, in our society, you have to have literacy skills. But what makes that relevant to somebody who feels that they haven't been successful in school? And that's the art piece of that literature provides. So when you start reading about stories, you get invested in the story. You want to learn more because that's the art piece. We encourage our women to write poetry and keep journals. This is also part of the art. So the art provides the hope and the sort of context of why this is valuable. Because you're learning things. You're learning new ideas. You're exploring new ideas.
From either the women themselves or people outside that are interviewing you or talking to you, what do you say to people who consider art to be frivolous and it not be an essential skill to develop? You touched on that already. So first from maybe women who are skeptical of the program themselves that are entering it, or and maybe potential partners or other people you talk to in the community at large.
I view the literacy as the skill set that's needed. It provides the tool. The thing about the art piece where you're starting to explore ideas, and that's what art's about. It's about exploring ideas, looking at things on a different level. And when they start to, through that art piece, see that words have value and meaning, then they're able to integrate that into their sort of new way of thinking and new ideas about identity.
So how does this work in practice? What do the actual reading circles look like?
So we meet on a weekly basis for an hour and a half at the center where the women are receiving services. So we go to them. They come into the circle. We begin reading the book out loud. And we do sort of a recap for those that may be a little bit behind on the weekly reading assignment, partly because they have other stressors in their life and they haven't had time to read, so that everybody's always on the same page in terms of what the story is. In the reading, everybody gets a turn to read out loud if they choose to. If they don't choose to, that's okay. They just say pass. And if any of the women are reading and they're sort of challenged by some of the vocabulary, they all help each other with the words, so that the story, the context of the story is never lost in ideas of trying to figure out a word or whatever. And then we have a conversation about the theme for the day that the reading would encapsulate. And then at the end of it, we do, for about a half an hour, some poetry writing. That work is collected and it's printed in an anthology, which the women get a copy of and can just, you know, give out to friends and family. We give them books for their children, and we talk about reading appropriate books to kids. We progress as the child gets older into different books that would be appropriate for their age, and we try to select books that the characters would reflect the background of the individuals who are reading it.
Now, is that a hard thing to come by? I know that the books I read in high school were usually centered on white male characters.
It is hard. But we do find them, and you know, all of our books are very diverse because our population is diverse. So we start with a book called The Coldest Winter Ever, which is pretty hardcore pulp fiction, and it's about a young woman who is the daughter of a drug dealer in New York. He is arrested, and She's 16 and she is attempting to follow in her father's footsteps in terms of the power that he had and the money that he had, and eventually it all goes wrong. But the beautiful thing about that book is it's a straight narrative. So there's, for a person who's an unsophisticated reader, it's a very easy thing to read. Also, there's a lot of issues and incidents that come up in the book that many of the women themselves have experienced. And so they're able to have really interesting conversations about their own situations, but they don't have to do any personal disclosures. They can do it through the third person and the character of the book. And they end up, it's really interesting to watch, because the character in the book is a very strong woman who, you know, perhaps if she had more experience, she would be able to use those skills in a more positive way, but it ends up, you know, backfiring on her because she doesn't have the support to be able to use those skills positively. So the women, they all read the book. You know, many of them never actually read a book before. And it's really interesting how proud they are of themselves to be able to say they actually read a book. And they start to redefine themselves as readers. So that's the first big leap, and we call it sort of the drug of entry into reading. As we move through the year, we start to introduce, slowly but surely, a little more sophisticated reading, so that at the end of the year, we're reading The Book of Negroes by Lawrence Hill.
Which is a great book.
It's a great book.
Yeah. I don't know if they're starting to read that in public schools, but I think that they should if they haven't yet.
But I agree with you. I mean, part of the problem is that for kids who are marginalized, whether they're white or whether they're black or whether they're South Asian or whether they're Aboriginal, if they don't see themselves in the characters of the book in high school and they're struggling with reading, literacy, comprehension, and all of those issues around literacy, it's very difficult for them to be able to get engaged in the reading. I'll give you an example. So somebody gave me children's books where the characters, the parents, and the children were black. And I gave those books to a couple of young dads who were not necessarily totally involved with their children. They were absent. And it was really interesting to me how they all made a point of coming back and saying that they were reading that book to their kids every night. It takes them to a place of sort of getting out of this kind of stereotypical idea of what readers are and what education is.
And who books are for.
Exactly. Yeah. Do you know, many years ago, I remember a young guy saying to me, you know, reading's for white kids. I said, well, actually it's for everybody. I mean, if you can't read, you're going to be disadvantaged in terms of being able to get good employment. But when I thought about it, I understood where he was coming from, because as you said, in high school, these kids are not seeing themselves in the characters that are in the books. I think it's slowly changing, but, you know, it's a big elephant to move because curriculums are set up in advance. They may not be involved in having community engagement. I think the best resource in many schools, to be honest with you, are librarians, because they know what's out there and what the kids will read. But those things are not necessarily incorporated into a curriculum.
And even if the characters may be more diverse representations, I know that there's a push to keep more kind of explicit novels out of schools, whether by explicit I just mean tackling kind of more difficult and horrific realities that certain populations face. And I know I read an article a few years ago in defense of literature that tackles these really hard issues by Sherman Alexie. I don't know if that's an author that you have explored, but he is a Native American writer who wrote a young adult novel called I think it's The Absolutely True Story of a Part-Time Indian. And it's about growing up on a reservation. And it's really, really funny, first of all, but it also deals with all of the horrific realities of being on a reservation. And that book got banned from a lot of schools. And he wrote a whole article about just that those kids have seen so much in their real lives. What do you think that you're protecting them from when you're taking away this literature that actually can speak to them? So I think even beyond just the, like, literally having people that are not white in books, it's also just bringing in those really truthful stories, which is what the first book you spoke about.
Yeah, and that's what we're trying to do. And I mean, I'm not naive. I realize that within a school system, it's a challenging thing to bring those in, because you're going to have, you know, you also have a diverse population within the school system, and it it is directed toward most people. And, you know, some parents do not want these topics discussed within a classroom. So we have the advantage of being able to do that. For the women that we're working with, they've seen all of this stuff. They need to have a place to be able to talk about it. And they're reluctant to have those conversations necessarily in the early days with their social worker, a nurse, or, you know, a program manager, because they're red flags. So they prefer not to get into those conversations. The nice thing about the reading circle is that because they can practice talking about it with each other, they can put what they're thinking and, you know, that was where I was, but this is where I want to go. So start setting goals about acknowledging that, you know, I was involved with perhaps a group of youth that were participating in activities that were negative, and but this isn't where I want to be anymore. But you still need to acknowledge some of that to be able to deconstruct it and understand where it is you're going to go. You know, if you don't understand why you were in a certain place, it's difficult to transition out of it. Plus, transitioning out of those places really often means that you have to let go of all of those friendships and you have to start building new friendships. So within the Reading Circle program, they can start to build friendships. And the focus is on the story, not about individual personalities. They start to be able to be more accepting of each other. It's remarkable how transformative it is, to be honest with you. It's a very simple idea, but it is incredibly transformative.
So what is some of the women's reactions being to experiencing that transformation? I mean, I imagine some of them, I mean, even regardless of the population background, people don't have this, they have a misconception that reading a book is just something that you do in your spare time and it doesn't really affect your life at large. Like, what have people been saying about how these reading groups and reading in general has affected the rest of their lives?
A couple of years ago, I was doing one of the groups, and this group was designed for women who've been teen mothers but were now in their early 20s. So a lot of programming stops once somebody reaches 20 or 21, depending on the center. And women in their 20s are reluctant to join groups where women are in their 30s. Like, there's just a social misconnect around age still. So they started this program. And the intent was that within 5 years, the women would be attending college or university and be gainfully employed. So I was working on an English language arts program. With the Reading Circle Plus, we were doing formal literacy training, but we were doing it in the form of writing stories and that kind of a different tack than working out of a book. And a lot of one-on-one tutoring. And she said to me, I said, you know, if you have the opportunity, I recommend that you take a women's studies course. You will learn a lot that you didn't know about the history of women and their power and, you know. And so one of them said to me, well, you just don't get it. And I said, well, what don't I get? And she said, we're not going to go into these programs because we feel stupid. And I'm telling you, I worked with these women for several months. They are not stupid. They are smart women. But they lack experience. And so we wrote the story around. So I started doing question and answering with them. And then the conversation became, well, my neighbor has a Harley Davidson. And I look at it and I always think I'd like to drive that thing. But of course, if I got on it, I would probably have a serious accident before I got to the end of the driveway, because I have no experience driving a motorcycle. Does that make me stupid? No, it just makes me someone who doesn't have any experience driving a motorcycle. And perhaps nobody there to teach me how to do it or work with me to learn it. And so this is no different than what we're talking about here. And it was very interesting because the next week, you know, we finished up the group, and the next week I touched on a little bit again, and all of a sudden they were supposed to be writing a 5-paragraph essay about something that was interesting to them, and the assignment was getting delayed, they weren't handing it in. All of a sudden I was literally surrounded by all of them to sit down with them. The particular woman that said that to me, she went back to high school to get her English accreditation, and with the intention of going into nursing. And she had a setback last year because she got badly beaten up by her boyfriend and had to drop out of school for a few months. But she's back. Like, she is determined that she can do this because she can do it. And she knows she can do it. These setbacks are kind of bumps in the road. They're not going to dissuade her from reaching that goal. So I view our program as transformative in that way. It's like resetting how these women view themselves, and focusing on you're not a victim, you're a survivor. So you have to take the strength of your experience and set your goals and work toward those goals to be successful. And these are the things that start to become transformative for these women.
Yeah. And before we wrap it up, what I'd like you to talk a bit more about was the intergenerational aspect and how you've talked about the transformative experience for these women and how this has affected their lives. But how has it been for their relationships with their kids and reading?
A few years ago, one woman said to me she'd been in a really abusive relationship and it broke up. She was heartbroken. And she said she'd been crying and upset, and her son, who was 3, came to her with a book, and a child's book, and asked her to read to him. And she said to me, when I put him on my knee and I started reading to him, all of a sudden I stopped crying. I calmed right down, and I realized that the most important thing that I'm doing right now is bonding with my child. So not only is she teaching her child good literacy skills and language, and he's learning from her reading to him, she's also bonding with him on a different level. The book becomes a focus for their interaction. It's a creative activity, but it's still grounded in learning. This is a little off the topic, but 36% of women in Ontario who live below the poverty line who are teenagers will get pregnant in a year. Only 2% of those living above a poverty line will get pregnant in a year. And those women are under 18 years of age. They never get out of the cycle of being dependent on social services. And in my experience, nobody should have to live like that. You have limited choices. You've got somebody managing you all of the time. You can't even keep a bank account to be able to access, like build up resources to access education. You can get a student loan, but it means that you don't have the support system that social services would provide in terms of medical and whatnot. And this is impactful on the kids, because if a child is having problems in school because they haven't been prepared for school, a mother's she doesn't feel confident or competent to go in and have a conversation with the teacher. And if she isn't, then, you know, the situation that may be challenging for the child is never properly addressed.
Mm-hmm. The impact of reading a book exploring narratives that are similar to the women's lives, that they're able to talk more about their own experiences through these books in a much safer environment. And that would be, I would think, especially important to this population who, if you're going through all the social work, welfare system, you're forced to expose yourself constantly. And so that does feed into the idea of like being a victim, because every single person you meet in every part of the bureaucracy, you have to tell your story to. And so on the one hand, I mean, there's this idea that it's better to talk things through, but it's just in this very overexposed way. Like, I know I worked at a women's shelter for a bit, and the people would not know who I was when they walked into the door, but yet I had to sit with them and they had to tell me if they were HIV positive and all of these really personal things. And I remember thinking, like, this is just a small part of their day, and I'm just a stranger that they have to say this to. And you wouldn't get an experience like talking about books in a much different, more controlled and relaxed environment. It's entirely important, and I've never really thought about it in that way before.
Yeah, it's really interesting because, as you say, you know, and they're challenged, like, to go into community health center because maybe they have some issue, maybe they have an STD, for example. They know that if they go into a community health center, everybody that works there is going to know their business.
Yeah.
Because that's part of the protocol. They have to report to each other. The files are kept. It's not like, you know, if I walk in to my doctor with an STD, yes, he has me have to report it to the health authorities, but everybody in the room isn't going to know my business.
Yeah.
And that's debilitating in terms of being able to access the kinds of resources that you probably need and that your children need as well. And your children having the confidence, you know, if you have a confident mother, you're going to have a confident child. So this is like for every woman that is experiencing this program, the residual benefit is their children. In fact, when I started this program, it was always about their children. It was about getting women in a place where they were confident and self-reliant to be able to parent their children. Because in my view, with the experiences that I saw when I was teaching, you know, kids that were really troubled, there was a lot of problems going on at home. And so what we're trying to do is bring literacy into the home before kids start school. Over and over again, I get letters like this. I mean, there's another one here. The women always refer back to, this is what I'm doing, my daughter is going to be doing this too. This is what I'm doing, my son is doing really well in school. And I get phone calls, lots of phone calls from women who I maybe met when their children were real babies, and they call me to say, I just want you to know my child's just started school and he's doing really well. For every book that these women read, they share it with their girlfriends, their mothers, their aunts, their boyfriends. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, each book becomes, it's kind of about sort of spreading this as being accessible to everybody.
Ink to the paper is a different energy in it. It helped bring things out of me that I didn't think I'd write about. I mean, it helped bring out a lot of emotions that were tearing away inside, and yeah, just helped free up a lot of energy inside of me, negative energy that, and good energy. So,
for colored girls who are born into poverty, who have no clue of where they've come from and pray to understand where they are presently and why. For colored girls who don't give in to weak, wicked minds, deceitful tricks, who question their existence, purpose, and circumstances. For colored girls that break down barriers, who recognize their own character and are not afraid to show it. Who carry dignity in their hearts and exceed limitations. For colored girls who do not let devastation of this poverty eat them alive. For colored girls who strive for what they truly love. For colored girls who love themselves enough to say enough is enough of hurt and rejoice in the glory of their own salvation. For colored girls who built this nation and still suffer from discrimination, who even after pain can forgive those who inflicted that pain upon them. For colored girls who can forgive themselves from having fallen victim to a system that helps and hates them at the same time. For colored girls who do not settle for less or accept second best, but can rise to the occasion to provide for self when there are opposing situations, never crying in joy and laughs at those who do, forgetting sorrows, ready to move on forward, only looking back for those who get left behind to pull them onward. Reality is her paradise.
It is a window to freedom for me. It's like the only window I have right now, seeing that I can't do a lot of what I really want to do. I just feel it feels right. It feels natural when you do it. I once read, when I was reading The Diary of Anne Frank when I was 9, and in there she has a quote that says, "Paper is more patient than people." And it is true. You can't tell a person how you feel without getting a reaction or being afraid of the reaction. But you write it down on paper or in your diary and you close that book and you store it away, you feel like you've told them because it's out.
Haley, born with fair skin, full lips, beautiful brown eyes, looking right towards the sky. 5 hours and 20 minutes, she's all mine. My arms cradled her while my hands held her tight, for this night was the best night of my life. Morning has come, already my worry has begun. To me she was perfection, deserved all of my love and affection. But life had a whole nother lesson for her. Society's definition of beautiful stood at the extent of her long curly hair. How would I tell her? Should I start by saying there's no such thing as black and white, just a world full of people filled with insecurities they feel they must hide?
We just heard from Roots Kizzy and Shanae Smith, two participants in Literature for Life's reading circles and writing groups. To find out more about Literature for Life, visit their website at literatureforlife.org, and they're also on Facebook and Twitter.
Thanks to Joe Altilia from Literature for Life for speaking with Ellie. I'm Ariana, and you can hear us live every Monday at 12 noon on Vancouver's Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM, and you can listen online at coopradio.org. If you have comments or feedback, you can email us at feminisms@gmail.com. If you miss the show, you can always find our podcasts on rabble.ca.